the fight against ISIS.
Well, let's talk about the French. 2 weeks exactly, trying days. What does it look like at this moment in time?
Well, people are scared still. They're jittery, but they're angry and defiant. There's been a lot of emotions over the last 2 weeks, but they're in complete solidarity. There are no divisions. The people attacked came from every background, Renee, every religion, every walk of life. The only commonality, really, was that they were mostly young people. So the French feel that their values and way of life have been attacked. And as one woman said to me yesterday, who doesn't go to a cafe?
So what would you say? Probably a mix, but more fear, patriotism?
You know, Renee, I feel, and from what I've been hearing and seeing, that there's been more patriotism. There's a huge explosion of patriotism. And here's just an anecdote to sum it up. Hollande asked people to display the French flag in their homes. Now, the French have a completely different relationship with the flag than Americans. Americans put the flag out. But in France, it's something on public buildings and maybe sporting events. But it's, to personally wave it is considered something the far right does. But they can't sell enough of them now. Everyone is putting flags up. They say that the flag is imbued with a new meaning. It means togetherness, not military conquest or politics. It means togetherness of all peoples, a way of life, going out to cafes, a French way of life that someone has tried to snuff out, and people are rising up and saying no. And there's been a lot of people joining the army as well, just like after 9/11 in the U.S., a huge burst of patriotism, people who want to defend their nation and their way of living.
Eleanor, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Renee.
That's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley speaking to us from Paris. And this holiday weekend in the U.S., between Black Friday and Cyber Monday, America will be buying billions of dollars worth of technology. For many small tech firms pushing a new product, how much they sell over the next few days can be make or break. From Austin, Texas, reporter Brenda Salinas has the story of what one startup is trying to do to come out with a winner.
Peter Lee is launching a brand new fitness tracker just in time for Black Friday.
Here we go. It's so cold.
He's taking a break, testing the tracker underwater. A former competitive swimmer, Lee used to track his workouts on a soggy notebook. That's what inspired him to create the Atlas. It's an LED heart rate monitor you wear on your wrist with a 3D mapping sensor. So the Atlas knows exactly how many push-ups you did or how well you swam.
Average heart rate was 144, 10% increase from last time. Says my form was a C. It's been a while since I've been in the water.
Lee's been too busy taking his tracker from beta tested to launch ready.
It's like before a race or before any sort of competition, you get sort of get like a little bit of butterflies, but it's sort of more like excitement and anticipation than fear, I'd say.
Lee is entering a very crowded market. You can choose from more than 24 fitness trackers this holiday season. Lily Pressesuit reviews them for the online publication TechCrunch. She's curious about the Atlas.
It seems really interesting, whether it's yelling at you from your wrist or through metrics on your computer, is pretty appealing.
Lee is selling his tracker directly to consumers, and unlike his competitors, he's only advertising online. Pressesuit says that could be a problem.
Definitely people want to try it on to see if it fits right, to see if it looks good, and even just to push some buttons to see what it looks like.
For Peter Lee, the creator of the Atlas, this is a high-stakes weekend.
Black Friday is a huge season for wrist-worn devices. So for us, shipping before then gives us the opportunity to prove to the world and to the market that this is feasible and this is possible in a product that you can buy.
Lee's only advertising on social media. That's not a lot of reach, but that's not necessarily a bad thing, says Ben Benson. He studies the marketing of technology at the University of Texas. He says Lee's plan will work if he generates buzz in a niche market.
The challenge for any brand on Black Friday is to get people talking about them. And if people are talking about their brand, they'll go find them. Everybody knows how to put the name of a brand into a search bar and go find it.
Lee is targeting hardcore fitness fanatics, mostly the CrossFit crowd. He's hoping word of mouth, both in gyms and online, will be enough to make the Atlas a hit. By Tuesday, he'll have a better idea of whether that's happening. In Austin, I'm Brenda Salinas for NPR News.
30 years ago, on the day after Thanksgiving, one of the most valuable paintings of the 20th century was stolen from an Arizona museum, and that painting's whereabouts is still a mystery. Vanessa Barchfield of Arizona Public Media reports.
Staff at the University of Arizona Museum of Art in Tucson were getting to work, just like any other day.
And the security guards opened the door for one of the staff members, and two people followed behind.
Olivia Miller, who's the museum's curator today, says it was close enough to opening time that the guards let the man and woman come in. They started climbing a flight of stairs to the second floor, and the guard followed. In the middle of the stairwell, though, the woman stopped and turned to chat with the guard. Her partner continued on up.
A short time later, the man came back down the stairs and he and the woman left.
A little odd, the guard thought. Then he walked up to the second floor gallery to discover any guard's worst nightmare, an empty frame where one of the institution's most prized pieces had hung. Willem de Kooning's painting, Woman Ochre, had been sliced out of its frame. The painting is part of the Abstract Expressionist's celebrated Woman series. Another work in the series sold about a decade ago for more than $137 million. The museum estimates that today, its painting could be worth as much as $160 million. It was a huge loss. University of Arizona Police Chief Brian Seastone was a campus cop 30 years ago and was one of the first investigators to arrive at the scene.
It was an almost hollow experience because it was so empty.
And to make matters worse, there were basically no leads, no fingerprints, no license plate from the getaway car, just a description of how the couple looked.
The woman was a bit older. She had a scarf around her head. She was wearing glasses. The man had dark hair, had a mustache.
That's all the cops had to work with because it turns out in 1985, the museum didn't have any security cameras. No one who was working at the museum that day wanted to be interviewed. And the question remains, where is the painting? Irene Romano, a professor at the University of Arizona and an expert on art plunder, says in general, people who steal works like this are not art lovers.
They're hired by others to do the dirty work, and then the works of art pass into the underworld and are traded for drugs and arms and cash.
Today, all the public can see of Woman Ochre are the frayed edges of the canvas in its empty frame. The museum sometimes puts that on display. Curator Olivia Miller says the case remains open.
We'll always keep hope that the painting will come back. And at the same time, we're always going to know that our collection is incomplete. And that's the sad part about it.
The University of Arizona Museum of Art got just $400,000 in insurance money for the painting, which it used to install cameras and beef up security. And these days, it stays closed the day after Thanksgiving. For NPR News, I'm Vanessa Barchfield.
This is NPR News.
It's 8:18. Good morning. Thanks for tuning in to Wisconsin Public Radio. Still to come on Morning Edition, headlines from NPR and WPR. Those will be up in just a couple minutes. There's a waiting list for a free legal clinic that's helped hundreds of Wisconsin businesses get their start. More from WPR's Parth Shah in just a couple minutes.
Support for WGTD comes from Carthage College, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. More information is available online at carthage.edu/grad.
Along with a selection of Bach cantatas and more, Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support live music performance. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Russia's foreign minister says Moscow is suspending visa-free travel with Turkey. The announcement from Sergei Lavrov follows the shootdown of a Russian bomber by Turkish F-16s. Moscow denies the bomber violated Turkish airspace. Some in northern Syria say they're seeing members of the U.S. military on the ground there. NPR's Alice Fordham reports.
The U.S. hasn't confirmed the forces are there, but it has previously said there will be some troops going in a training and advising role. The Kurdish forces in that part of Syria are the U.S.'s partners in a plan to move on the ISIS-held city of Raqqa, though some people have raised concerns that a Kurdish force moving on an Arab city could create ethnic tensions.
California's Taylor Farms Pacific is at the center of a produce recall linked to an E. coli outbreak. As Bob Hensley reports, the problem is contaminated celery in some salads sold at Costco.
Consumers who purchased Costco's chicken salad with rotisserie chicken prior to November 20th are advised to throw it out. The warning is the latest included in a recent outbreak of E. coli that has affected seven states, including California. At least 19 people have become ill. Five have been hospitalized. No deaths have been reported.
Most of the illnesses have been reported in Montana, Utah, and Colorado. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. A free legal clinic for entrepreneurs has helped hundreds of Wisconsin businesses open up shop. As Parth Shaw reports, there's a waiting list for the service.
The UW-Madison Law and Entrepreneurship Clinic is run by a group of 20 law students. Under the mentorship of licensed attorneys, they provide legal help to startups. Clinic Director Ann Smith says these law students are kept busy.
Last year, our students would have billed 8,300 hours of time. And if you multiply that by a reasonable billing rate, you get almost $2 million worth of legal services that clients got for free.
Smith says her clinic served more than 300 clients last year. While some other law schools provide free legal services as well,
we asked other clinics, quote, like ours, how many clients they served in a year, and the closest number to ours was 50.
75% of the startups the clinic advised are still in business today. Parth Shaw, Wisconsin Public Radio.
U.S. House Democrat Ron Kind of La Crosse says at least several nations will have to band together to defeat the Islamic State. Since the Paris attacks, France and Russia stepped up their efforts to attack ISIS bases. The United States still has bombing missions for selected targets. Kind says the U.S. needs to be more vigilant and form an international coalition that can take territory away from the Islamic State. He says he favors continued airborne attacks, but says it would be a mistake to consider ground troops.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Home Instead Senior Care, with a range of in-home senior care services to keep aging loved ones at home, from companionship and help around the house to medication reminders and Alzheimer's care at homeinstead.com/NPR. From the Kauffman Foundation, creators of Global Entrepreneurship Week, a celebration of entrepreneurs who bring ideas to life and start businesses that create jobs and drive economic growth. Kauffman.org/GEW. And from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, working to improve the quality of people's lives by supporting the performing arts, the environment, medical research, and child well-being. Information is available at ddcf.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne. It costs NASA a boatload of money to send equipment to Mars, which is why when the space agency chooses the instruments to send on a rover mission, it chooses ones it expects will yield the most valuable scientific data. NPR science correspondent Joe Palca began to wonder if cool ever trumps science when he learned about a plan to send a helicopter drone to Mars.
It might not quite make it to one of my big ideas, but it sure is a cool idea. Imagine. You put a camera on the helicopter. It lifts off. The opening shot, a panorama taken of the Martian hills. Then we pan to the right, and we see a NASA rover sitting majestically on the edge of a crater. But wait a minute. I thought there wasn't a lot of atmosphere on Mars, not enough air for the helicopter rotors to push against. NASA scientist Matthew Gollenbeck says, yes, the atmosphere on Mars is pretty thin.
But there is enough atmosphere to actually do stuff with wings or rotors.
He says they've tested that in a chamber that simulates the Martian atmosphere here on Earth. Now, Gollenbeck works at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and as a serious scientist, his first reason for wanting a helicopter drone on a Mars rover mission isn't poetic or cool, it's scientific.
The rover spends a fair amount of time wandering around looking for the good stuff to go analyze. And the idea for the helicopter is if you could get that beforehand, then the rover wouldn't need to wander around. It would know exactly where to go. Where are the best outcrops? Where are the key relations that you want to study?
The helicopter drone Gollenbeck wants to send to Mars is a pretty simple affair.
It has 2 3-foot-long rotor blades that rotate in opposite directions for stability. Below the rotors are a couple of boxes, about the size of tissue boxes, that hold the drone's electronics.
Mounted on the outside of this is a small camera that takes pictures. And that's it.
The whole thing weighs just a bit more than 2 pounds. And to keep costs down, Golombek says they've tried to use off-the-shelf parts.
What we had for our initial concept was a GoPro camera. I mean, literally right out of the box.
Well, I guess it's good to know your GoPro will work on Mars if you're going there on vacation. As I said, Golombek is a serious guy. But that doesn't mean he's immune to a kind of magical feeling that comes from working on the team that's running the Mars rover Opportunity, a rover that's been roving for almost 12 years now.
We have a presence on Mars, a continuous presence on Mars, with a bunch of people that are Martians. I'm a Martian. I'm on Mars. And it may be not me personally, but my brain is there with the rover.
And Golombek says pictures from a helicopter flying above a rover rolling across Mars will only reinforce that feeling of being there.
And in a sense, that's humanity being on another planet. First small step.
But it may be a while before we can take that first small step. For now, at least, cool didn't trump science. NASA decided against putting the drone on the next mission to Mars in 2020, in part because the agency wanted to be sure it would work on Mars as advertised. Now, the mission after that? We'll wait and see. Joe Palca, NPR News.
In professional sports, a split-second decision can cost the team a game. Boston's Bill Buckner missing a routine ground ball during the World Series. DeSean Jackson dropping the football a yard before crossing the goal line. Then there was the blunder on Thanksgiving Day in 1993 when the Miami Dolphins played the Dallas Cowboys. NPR's Daniel Hajek has the story.
The Cowboys defensive tackle Leon Lett made a big mistake that haunts him 22 years later.
I avoided talking about it. I avoided dealing with it. It was just one of the worst days of my NFL career.
It was a freezing day in Irving, Texas. Winds blew sheets of snow and sleet into the Texas stadium. Players were falling and fumbling like they were on an ice skating rink. This was when Troy Aikman was the Cowboys' star quarterback, and the Dolphins were led by legendary coach Don Shula. It was the Thanksgiving showdown. With 15 seconds left in the game, Miami was down by 1. All they needed was a field goal. It was the Dolphins' last shot at winning. Miami kicked the ball, and the Dallas defensive line reached up to block it. You can hear it in this clip posted by the NFL. It's a big play.
It's a 41-yarder. It's a first down kick, and it's blocked! It's blocked and rolled.
The stadium erupts. The blocked football spins like a top on the snow-packed field. The announcers yell, "Cowboys win." Then, all of a sudden, a white jersey, a Dallas player, Leon Lett, number 78, appears out of nowhere.
Not making any excuses, I think I kind of got the rules mixed up there. You know, I just kept hustling, trying to make a play.
As the Dallas sideline celebrated, Lett thinks the play is still going, and he headed straight for the ball. If he touches it, the football is back in play. A huge mistake when the Cowboys are mere seconds from winning. But Lett didn't just touch the ball.
I was all out. Full speed down the field, and I ended up sliding into it.
He slipped on the ice and accidentally kicked it. He lost control of the football. It was an all-out scramble to recover it as the Cowboys' victory hung in the balance.
Leon Lett! Oh, my goodness gracious.
Worst possible outcome, Miami recovers the ball, and that's exactly what happened. Dolphins center Jeff Dollenbach was right there.
I just caught him kind of on my peripheral vision, you know, so he's probably about next to me when he came diving in there, and instincts were to get on the ball.
And just like that, with 3 seconds left, the Dolphins get another shot at scoring. This time, the field goal is good. Miami wins the Thanksgiving game 16-14, and Leon Lett has been blamed ever since.
Of course, my teammates and the coaching staff were all upset, and I could understand that. And I was upset. I had basically messed it up for the entire team.
Lett went to the locker room devastated, but one bad play doesn't define a season. The Dallas Cowboys went on to win the Super Bowl that year. Leon Lett became a decorated defensive tackle, and he's still with the Cowboys as an assistant defensive line coach. the first thing he tells his players, if your team blocks a field goal, don't touch the ball. Daniel Hajek, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Look at Barbie. She's become
a holiday favorite for more than 50 years.
Barbie is a brand that is all about imagination and storytelling.
Barbie's story changes with the times.
I had the most fantastic day in the office.
The real message ought to be how unlike any real person this doll is.
Barbie Through the Years, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune into All Things Considered at 3 this afternoon or listen online at WPR.org.
Good morning, I'm Renee Montaigne. Researchers at Tufts University are teaching robots a technique teenagers long ago mastered, how to say no to an order. When the researcher asks a robot to walk off a ledge, the robot asks itself, do I know how to? Am I able to? Am I obligated based on my social role? The robot looks at the ledge and concludes,
but it is unsafe.
Yeah, and he didn't jump. It's morning edition.
Good morning, it's 8:31. Thanks for tuning in to Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Still to come this hour, it's Wisconsin Life. Today, meet the harmonious singing sensations, the Cordettes, the group from Sheboygan full of innocent charm. That's Wisconsin Life coming up in 15 minutes here on WPR.
Support for WPR comes from the Opal Man Gallery of Fine Opal Jewelry in Spring Green, Wisconsin, featuring natural, colorful opals in artistic settings of silver and gold. Natural, genuine perfection. More at theopalman.com.
Support for WGTD comes from Vero International Cuisine in Racine on 6th Avenue near Monument Square, featuring American food with an international twist in a serene setting with intimate and exotic touches. Online at VeroInternationalCuisine.com.
Think about the things you spend $100 a month on. Your phone, cable, restaurants. If your daily dose of WPR news, music, and conversation is just as valuable to you, become a $100 a month sustainer and join the 9XM Leadership Circle. Your gift will provide a stable financial base for Wisconsin Public Radio and our programs. Set it up at WPR.org. Just click donate. Thank you.
It's mostly cloudy this morning in Wisconsin. It'll become partly cloudy as the day goes on. There is a slight chance of light freezing rain. Highs will reach near 30, except in the lower to mid-30s near Lake Michigan. For tonight, clear skies with lows in the 20s, except in the teens in the far north. And for tomorrow, clear skies with highs in the lower to mid-30s, except warmer near Lake Superior at near 40.
NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Universal Pictures. Presenting Legend, a new film based on the true story of London gangsters Ron and Reggie Cray, both portrayed by Tom Hardy, now playing in select theaters. From the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives. Supporting efforts to make education more affordable for students and flexible for teachers through open educational resources. Online at Hewlett.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. Papa Francis, as he's known in Africa, travels from Kenya to Uganda today, the second stop on his trip to Africa. The Pope began this morning in a place world leaders more typically avoid, an impoverished neighborhood of Nairobi. NPR's Silvio Pajoli is traveling with Francis and joins us now to talk more about what he's been doing. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
Now, the Vatican does choose the Pope's itinerary quite carefully with his message in mind. So how is that playing out today there in Nairobi?
Today, Pope Francis went to visit one of the famous slums of Nairobi. Apparently, something like more than majority of the population in Nairobi live in slums. This was the Kangemi slum. And there he said that it's in poor neighborhoods that authentic wisdom is found.
And Sylvia, yesterday there in Nairobi, Francis celebrated Mass, of course, but afterward he spoke in a very secular setting, the UN Environmental Agency, which is based there. What did he say?
he spoke. And first of all, it's 4 days just before the very crucial Paris climate change talks start, and he has been really hammering on this issue all year. First, he did issued a teaching document called an encyclical in June, and then he spoke about this very forcefully at the UN in New York in September. And yesterday, he said it would be catastrophic if special interests prevail over the common good and lead to manipulation of information at the Paris conference. He didn't specify exactly what he meant, but it's clear that this is, again, this is one of his favorite themes. He's always expressed disdain for the less a fair consumer-oriented economic model, and for climate change deniers. He said this is an issue that cannot be ignored. Either we improve the environment or we destroy it.
And his final stop is in the Central African Republic. There has been a lot of talk about him going there because that country is in the midst of a vicious civil war. Is it possible that he will not make it there?
Well, as according to the Vatican spokesman yesterday, Father Federico Lombardi, absolutely nothing has changed. He actually said the closer the date comes, which will be Sunday, the less doubt there is about his going there. It certainly is fraught with a lot of risks. The situation is very, very tense there. There's been a lot of killings in the last few weeks. There are UN peacekeepers, but they have said that they will not deploy extra security for the Pope. He has an ambitious schedule there. He wants to even jumpstart the start of his Jubilee Year of Mercy by 10 days in the cathedral in the capital, Bangui. So he really wants to go. And the official Vatican daily, the Osservatore Romano, wrote yesterday that when he boarded the plane in Rome the other day, an Alitalia flight, he told the pilot, "I want to go to the Central African Republic, and if you can't manage it, give me a parachute."
Sylvia, thanks very much.
Thank you, Renee.
NPR's Sylvia Fagioli is traveling with Pope Francis in Africa, joining us from Nairobi. And one of the largest charities in the country is called Feeding America. That group distributes millions of pounds of food to food banks around the country. A while back, they had a problem. Their system for getting all that food to all those food banks was a mess. Jacob Goldstein from our Planet Money podcast reports on how they fixed it.
Here's the way it used to work at Feeding America. They'd get a big donation from, say, a pickle company, call up some local food bank and say, "How about a truckload of 5-gallon buckets of pickles?" This exact thing happened to Susanna Morgan a little more than 10 years ago. She was running a food bank in Alaska, and Susanna did not need pickles.
"You're kidding me. You're offering me pickles?"
Susanna needed produce, but she wasn't getting it. Other food banks were getting too much produce. Feeding America knew this was a problem. They had all this food to send out, but it was really hard to figure out who should get what.
It is a problem for someone else to make decisions for you when they don't know what's in your inventory at the moment. They don't know what your local donation supply is.
So they got together, had some meetings, and they invited a few economists to sit in. The economists told the food bankers, "What you guys have is a centrally planned economy. A few people in the center, in this case at Feeding America headquarters, are making decisions for everybody. What you need to do," the economist said, "is flip the whole thing around. Create a market economy." Candace Prendergast from the University of Chicago was one of those economists. And he says, at first, this did not go over well.
One of the food bankers came up to me and said, "Look, I'm a socialist. I have no interest in this. I'll listen to you, but I don't think I have any interest in this."
Candace and the other economists say, "Hear us out. Feeding America could have auctions. It would be like eBay, but for truckloads of yogurt or canned tomatoes. If a food bank wanted something, they could bid on it." Now, this was donated food. It wasn't going to work if the food banks had to bid real money. So the economist said, "Okay, create fake money. Give it to all the food banks, and they can use that to buy the donated food." Susanna Morgan says when the food bankers heard the whole plan, the fake money, the auctions,
the clouds opened and the angels sang.
No, that never happens.
I know, okay, maybe it wasn't quite that biblical, but there was literally this moment in which we just went, we have had a breakthrough.
Today, every food bank in the network gets a certain amount of fake money every day. The food banks that serve the most hungry people get the most fake money. And there are these eBay-style auctions where food banks can bid on food. With this system, Susanna Morgan was able to get more produce up in Alaska. Even the food banker who was a socialist came around in the end, Candace says.
What he realized was the market allows me to get a lot of pounds of food in a way that I did not get before.
Now, to be clear, it's not like the food bankers turned into free market zealots. Part of the system those economists designed lets food banks sell food to each other for fake money. But when food banks have extra food, they still often just give it away to other food banks. Susanna Morgan is at the Oregon Food Bank now, and she says there's a reason this part of the system never took off.
This is a network built on relationships. You're going to rely on those people for stealing their good fundraising practices. You're going to rely on those people for advertising the positions that you have open. And you can use food as one of the ways you nurture those relationships.
They've managed to keep this gift economy going, even as they're bidding against each other. Jacob Goldstein, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Athena Health, web-based EHR, revenue cycle management, and population health services. Athena Health, let doctors be doctors. Learn more at athenahealth.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News.
Good morning. It's 8:41. Thanks for tuning in to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Headlines are coming up next from NPR and WPR, and then in 10 minutes on Marketplace Morning Report. As holiday shopping is increasingly moving online, retailers find themselves facing bigger demand and tougher challenges for their websites and shippers. That plus all the morning's business news coming up in 10 minutes here on WPR.
Do you have accounting experience and a passion for public radio? Well, then you might just be who WPR is looking for to be the next financial manager for the Wisconsin Public Radio Association. You'll help provide financial stewardship of member donations. Find information about this and other WPR jobs at wpr.org/jobs. For best consideration, apply by November 30th. The University of Wisconsin Extension is an equal employment opportunity and affirmative action employer.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. French President François Hollande is vowing to destroy those responsible for the Paris terror attacks. He spoke today at a remembrance ceremony honoring the 130 people killed 2 weeks ago by ISIS militants. In Germany today, police are offering few details about the arrest of a man in Stuttgart. Esme Nicholson reports.
The 34-year-old man is suspected of trading arms, but they would not comment on media reports suggesting the suspect is linked to the Paris attacks. In Berlin, police arrested three men Thursday on suspicion of planning an attack on the city of Dortmund. Police confirm they have since been released because no weapons were found.
This is Black Friday, typically the busiest shopping day of the year in the U.S. Stores and shopping malls are crowded with those looking for discounts. NPR's Sonari Glinton says others are shopping for deals with their phones.
The big retail chains like Amazon and Target and Walmart have all been investing billions of dollars in smartphone technology so that you can buy something from the store, pick it up in the store, use it to get a coupon. That is the most important thing this season, is to see if there's any stickiness with the mobile applications.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down 34 points, the Nasdaq up 3. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Maureen McCollum. For the first time in state history, Wisconsin hunters are registering their deer electronically during the state's 9-day gun deer hunt. As Rich Kramer reports, the DNR says the system has already been put to the test and hunters are adapting.
Whether they pick up the phone or go online, deer hunters must now register their kills electronically. It's the biggest change to the 2015 gun deer season, but DNR big game ecologist Kevin Wallenfang expects the transition away from physical registration at gas stations or taverns to go smoothly. He says since September 12th, hunters have registered more than 60,000 deer electronically.
The vast majority of the hunters that I've spoken with, they find the system very easy. They like it. They're kind of asking the question, why did it take so long for us to get to this point?
Wallenfang says hunters can get help if they bring their deer to one of 250 registration stations around the state, but the deer data will still be recorded electronically. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Wisconsin is drying out after one of its wettest Thanksgivings ever.
Milwaukee had about 1.5 inches, a record for both Thanksgiving and November 26th. Madison also broke both records with almost 1.2 inches. La Crosse had its wettest Thanksgiving since 1940 with a half inch. Green Bay had just short of 1.25 inches, much of it falling during last night's 17-13 Packers loss to the Bears. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations. And from Universal Pictures, presenting Legend, a new film based on the true story of London gangsters Ron and Reggie Cray, both portrayed by Tom Hardy, now playing in select theaters. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to prepare all students for a lifetime of opportunity by ensuring access to high-quality K-12 choices. More information is available at waltonk12.org. And from Americans for the Arts at americansforthearts.org.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. Wisconsin's bred many famous musicians, but perhaps none with as seemingly innocent charm as the Cordettes. Dean Robbins introduces us to the harmonious singing sensations from Sheboygan.
I've always imagined Wisconsin in the 1950s as an extraordinarily innocent place. What other conclusion can I draw after hearing the Cordettes?
Listen and we'll tell you how to bob a jack.
The Cordettes were a female vocal quartet formed by college friends in Sheboygan. They wore matching party dresses and shapely Donna Reed hairdos. The friends chose their name back when musical groups were earnest rather than edgy. Female bachelors were bachelorettes, so why wouldn't four women singing beautiful chords be the Cordettes? The group performed around Sheboygan, inspired by cheerful female pop acts like the Andrews Sisters and Boswell Sisters. One member's dad loved barbershop quartets, so that style became an influence too. The Cordettes' breakthrough was a winning performance on Arthur Godfrey's talent show in 1949. Godfrey made them regulars on his program, and that led to a contract with Cadence Records. Then came their first bid for pop immortality, 1954's Mr. Sandman.
Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream.
This two-minute gem stayed at number one for 7 weeks, and it's easy to see why. Nothing better represents the wholesome side of the 1950s. With sweet barbershop harmonies, the Cordettes pine for a cute guy to call their own. They want him to have wavy hair, and they think it would be peachy to meet him right away. Yes, they actually use the word peachy. Is it any wonder that the Bobby Soxers down at the malt shop made Mr. Sandman their anthem? Coincidentally, Elvis Presley cut his first record in 1954. And it wasn't long before rowdy rock and roll transformed the music business. While many old-fashioned vocal groups fell out of favor, the Cordettes tried to keep up with the times.
This is going to be a tremendous record. It's only been out 2 weeks. Featuring the Cordettes, Lollipop.
The rhythms were bolder than Mr. Sandman's, and the harmony sharper.
Lollipop, lollipop, oh,
still, no one would mistake the Cordettes for 1950s juvenile delinquents. Their version of Lollipop is about as clean-cut as the rock and roll genre ever got. In live performances of the new hit, they smiled graciously and threw candy to the audience. The Cordettes continued to top the charts at the dawn of the 1960s, but their days were clearly numbered. Bob Dylan and the Beatles would soon change our view of top 40 music, just as the feminist movement would soon change our view of women. Sheboygan's pop sensation broke up in 1961. I don't think I'd want to live in the absurdly innocent Wisconsin conjured up by Mr. Sandman, Lollipop, and the Cordettes' dozen other hits. But for 2 minutes at a time, it's an irresistible place to visit.
Dean Robbins is a writer and editor in Madison. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit our website at wisconsinlife.org and find us on Facebook. It's 10 minutes before 9 o'clock, and you're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us. The Marketplace Morning Report is coming up next, and then classical music starts at 9. Today, we include a horn concerto by Mozart and a new recording of a Bach keyboard suite. Music continues until 3, and we'll have a news update at noon. Peter Bryant is in for Stephanie Elkins this morning.
Support comes from Gateway Technical College. Is cooking your avocation? Make it your vocation. As a chef, baker, line cook, even a restaurant manager, hands-on training can lead to earnings as high as $70,000. Check out Gateway's Culinary Arts Program at gtc.edu.
For the NPR production, Planet Money. Wisconsin Public Radio encourages thought-provoking conversations and ideas. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
It's mostly cloudy in Wisconsin this morning, and it'll become partly cloudy as the day goes on. There's a slight chance of light freezing rain. Highs will reach near 30.
Support for WPR comes from the Aging and Disability Resource Center of Dane County, offering free assistance to help seniors and people with disabilities connect with services they need. DaneADRC.org or 608-240-7400.
Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, featuring Little Europa roasted nuts, salted cashews, and cinnamon sugar pecans, almonds, and peanuts. Also, sweet or spicy nut mixes. The Winter Market in the atrium of the Rhodie is open Saturdays from 9 to 1.
It is Black Friday, and retailers are trying to keep up with fast-changing shopping habits.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by the United States Postal Service, offering Holiday Forever stamps at local retailers. Supermarkets, drugstores, wholesale clubs, and office supply stores sell Holiday Forever stamps. And by Robert W. Baird & Company, a financial partner keeping clients' best interests in mind since 1919. BairdWealth.com has more information.
From APM in New York, I'm Noelle King, and for David Brancaccio. This holiday season, U.S. consumers are on track to spend more than ever. $630 billion, says a forecast from the National Retail Federation. But more and more holiday shopping is being done online, and that means retailers are facing bigger challenges for their websites and their shipping companies. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has a story.
Companies used to worry about whether their servers would melt down under increased holiday traffic. But now that they can easily contract additional servers, handling holiday demand isn't so stressful. Suresh Kota is a management professor at the University of Washington, right on Amazon's home turf.
Cloud computing is there, and adding incremental capacity is just a flick of a switch. So that's not a problem at all.
Being ready to make the sale is one thing. Getting it to customers can be trickier. The major shipping services expect to deliver more than 1.5 billion packages this holiday season. Shippers have more data than ever to predict demand and staff up accordingly. But the closer it gets to Christmas, the dicier things get, says Rod Sides, vice chair of Deloitte.
If sales are light at the beginning of the season, we may find that retailers may add some promotional activity at the end of the season, which could create a spike at the end that would put a lot of pressure on existing infrastructure.
And as always, exceptionally bad weather could render all the planning and big data useless. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Also from the National Retail Federation, 6 in 10 Americans now admit to self-gifting or buying themselves a holiday treat. Let's take a look at the numbers. It was a rough day for Asian markets. The Shanghai Composite slid 5.5%. Chinese authorities are expanding a crackdown on the country's securities industry, aimed at figuring out what caused wild market swings earlier this year. Here in the U.S., Wall Street rang the opening bell about 20 minutes ago. The Dow is down about 0.2%. The S&P up 0.4%. The Nasdaq is flat. The gambling industry has a problem. The American Gaming Association says millennials do not like to gamble, at least not as much as their parents. And casinos stand to lose big. Sally Herships has a story.
First of all, you should know millennials do like Vegas.
They like the food there. They like lots of moments that they can broadcast.
Like on Instagram, Mary Lee Bliss is with Ypulse, the youth market research firm. She says the problem is happening at the slot machines, where casinos are used to making a good chunk of their change. There are two issues. First,
that millennials are just naturally pretty risk averse.
There was the recession, and they have all that student debt. Next, she says millennials grew up playing more sophisticated games than the slots. That means the kind of games that will appeal to them.
Think like Angry Birds, but, you know, with money on the other end of it.
That's the kind of game G2 Game Design makes. Greg Jafria is the CEO.
It's a technical term for it would be a bifurcating morphing algorithm.
In plain English, those are games that combine wagering and skill. And Jafria says casinos and millennials want them.
Hurry up and finish.
In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, working to explore the next generation of targeted therapies for many cancers. Videos, white papers, and patient stories are available at discovercarebelieve.org. And by Avalara, tax automation for business. Avalara is designed to simplify business tax by performing real-time tax calculations and enabling automatic return filing. Avalara.com. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
U.S. programs for refugees and asylum seekers have come under scrutiny lately. Some lawmakers say the screening process isn't rigorous enough to prevent bad apples from slipping through. President Obama disagrees. Once in, asylum seekers have to set about making lives for themselves. Our Wealth and Poverty Desk spoke to a former surgeon from the Democratic Republic of Congo who was recently granted asylum. It took Didier Vakumbwa 6 years to go through the asylum process. He now lives in Los Angeles with his family. During the day, he works in a health clinic, and at night, he moonlights as a security guard.
This Didier, patient doesn't have insurance, right? My name is Didier Vakumbwa. I'm working here in this clinic. Patient cannot go to another doctor if he doesn't pass by me as a coordinator. So I'm like a bridge. I work as a medical doctor for more than 10 years. I work in the Congo, in many countries in Africa. But sometimes I have to do even surgery because they don't have light, they have electricity. Sometimes they have to use flashlights doing surgery. So I have to clock out. It's 3:30. So this is my day. My day is like that, crazy day. So I have to wake up in the morning and then come here in the clinic from 7 to 3:30 and then drive to Van Nuys. And then over there, I have to do my second job, that's a security job. I arrived in this country was in the end of 2008. So I have to forget everything. I have to forget that I was a doctor. I have to forget who I was and apply for housekeeping. I have to clean toilets. So I don't know what is my life in this country. There is a moment that I don't believe it's me. I say, come on, that is really me? But I say, yes. I work here in this building as a security guard. At 7, everything is locked. So I know that nobody can get in. So it's more quiet and more safe, so I just use this time reading books, medical books. In 5 years, I will be in the hospital as an MD. I'm really confident.
That was Didier Vakumbwa speaking with our Wealth and Poverty producer, Caitlin Esch. Last up, Pope Francis is in Kenya today, where he offered his thoughts on how to keep young people from being drawn in by extremist ideologies. Get them educated and get them jobs, Francis said. I'm Noelle King with the Marketplace Morning Report. This is APM, American Public Media.
Yeah, this is Wisconsin Public Radio. You can hear Marketplace this evening at 6:30, the evening report, right after All Things Considered here on WPR. Coming up in just a moment, classical music. Stay with us.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from many small businesses. This Saturday is Small Business Saturday, a day that encourages shopping and dining at local businesses. WPR is proud of the support we receive from small businesses across the state.
Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, featuring Little Europa roasted nuts, salted cashews, and cinnamon sugar pecans, almonds, and peanuts. Also, sweet or spicy nut mixes. The Winter Market in the atrium of the Rhody is open Saturdays from 9 to 1. You're listening to WGTD HD.